Thanks for listening to the Best of Herd Podcast. Be sure to catch us live every weekday from 12 to 3 Eastern, 9 to noon Pacific on Fox Sports Radio and FS1. Find your local station for the Herd at foxsportsradio.com or stream us live every day on the iHeartRadio app by searching Herd.
This is the Best of the Herd with Colin Cowherd on Fox Sports Radio.
What up? Welcome in. This is the Herd. Wherever you may be in, however you may be making this part of your day, thanks so much. I am Doug Gottlieb, filling in for Colin Cowherd on the iHeartRadio Network, Fox Sports Radio. No TV, so that means it's Naked Wednesdays. So it is Naked Wednesdays. No, not me, for you. You can be naked watching, listening to the show. We got a lot to get to. The Nuggets beat the Jazz last night, and while that's probably not going to be the most watched series, or a lot watched Game 7, it was very telling, and I think, you know, what we saw last night does play into the rest of the NBA playoffs. Also, it's why there's an alarming stat about James Harden as he gets ready for Game 7 tonight. It's not just about his Game 7 stats in the past. It's his fourth quarter and overtime stats. I'll tell you what I believe is behind that. Jeff Benedict's going to join us in an hour and a half. He's the author of a new book that, believe it or not, your boy Colin Cowherd told me you got to read this book. He is reading it. It's about the Patriots dynasty, what many believe is the end of the dynasty, the breakup of Belichick and Brady. Joel Klatt will join us as we have renewed energy in regards to the Big Ten possibly playing football this year. You have, if you're listening to us, you're coming off of listening most likely to Dan Patrick, also part of our Fox Sports Radio family, who said sources close to him told him October 10th is the date that they want to play football by so that the Big Ten can still compete in the college football playoff. Again, that doesn't mean it's happening. It just means that would be their target date. And in 30 minutes, Ben Golliver is going to join us. He is in the bubble. We'll get his sense of everything that's at stake tonight for Houston, for Mike D'Antoni, for James Harden, for Russell Westbrook. And, oh yeah, by the way, the Bucks don't want to go down two games none like the Toronto Raptors did last night. But let's start with the NFL. Let's start with Kirk Cousins. Right? In the Kirk Cousins is the guy who is most likely, by my estimation, to always say what would read as the right thing. Right? He does that, aw, gee, shucks. Doesn't he? It's almost, there's a little Russell Wilson to him as well, where it's like, did you take a class on PR and somebody told you this is what you're supposed to say? Because he does have a tendency to say what the media would most often tell you is the right thing. But many people in my position are using part of his quote to partially laugh at him, also laugh at some of the precautions we're taking in regards to COVID-19. And they're using it to make a bigger point, which honestly, he doesn't actually make if you read the whole quote. Okay. It is disingenuous to say that Kirk Cousins, by saying, if I die, I die, right? Which is, you guys are familiar, it's a famous quote from a movie, right? You die. It dies. But I'm going to be okay. Even if I die, I die. I kind of have peace at that. That's what everybody's talking about, right? People are talking, like, so let me read the quote. He was on with Kyle Brandt. KB is a friend, and he's on Good Morning Football. He has a pod. On that pod, Kirk Cousins said, I'm not going to call anybody stupid for the trouble it could get me in, but I'm about 0.0001. Right? So He is a little bit in denial of the actual numbers by anyone's estimation, because that's not what the percentages tell you. On the other hand, if he simply said, hey, there's a very, very slight chance that if I get COVID, that I'm going to get sick enough to actually have to be hospitalized or whatever. Now, look, some of this is a reaction to the CDC and their story that and their report that came out that 94% of people who died from COVID-19 died of comorbidities. So in addition to the fact that he's a professional athlete, he's in great shape, he doesn't have pre-existing health conditions, all of those, his numbers might be closer to accurate than inaccurate. He goes on, I want to respect other people's concerns, but for me, right, that's his way of saying no disrespect, but, and when somebody says no disrespect, what comes out of their mouth the very next sentence? Something usually disrespectful. But for me personally, if you're talking no one else can get the virus, what is your concern you could get it? I'd say I'm going to go about my daily life. If I get it, I'm going to ride it out. I'm going to let nature do its course. Survival of the fittest kind of approach. And just say, if it knocks me out, it knocks me out. I'm going to be okay. Even if I die, I die. I kind of have peace with that. That's what everyone's talking about. That's not the end of the quote. I guess not. I actually had to text a couple of my friends in the media who were slaughtering Kirk Cousins or laughing at people who are protective of COVID from COVID-19, whatever. And because there's another part. Wait, he said more? He said more. That's really where I fall on it. So my opinion on wearing masks is it's really about being respectful to other people. It has nothing to do with my personal thoughts. Wait, what? What Kirk Cousins is saying is I'm not a high risk. I'm not a low risk. I'm a very, very minimal risk. But you don't wear a mask simply because of yourself. You wear a mask because, by his estimation, okay, it's about being respectful. The truth is, it's a little bit more about being respectful. It's about not wanting to spread it to somebody who may have some underlying health issues. Somebody who's elderly or, in Cousins' case, his kids. Now, is he totally educated on the virus? No. Sometimes education is a very good thing. Sometimes partial education is not. There's a lot to this, right? Like the Big Ten, it feels like overreacted to being really well educated on it because there was a report that it's not a report. There's the statistics that show you can contract myocarditis if you get COVID-19, and in an athlete, myocarditis can cause sudden death. No one wants that for anyone, let alone for an athlete representing a university. But what if you read part of the quote, it feels like he's telling you it's not even as rough on your body as the flu. That's what people who want to believe that it's some sort of media creation. Oh, it's 5G cell phone towers only, right? You heard that one? Like, you heard all the different. He's saying, I don't think it's going to affect me, and if it does, I'm going to ride it out. And then he does the fake bravery thing. If I die, I die. But he goes back and essentially says, I'm going to wear a mask because it's not about me. It's about everybody else. Which is exactly how you should take it. Exactly how you should take it. You got to take it seriously and be a little bit over-precautious. And maybe you don't value your own health, or maybe you think I'm healthy as a horse, I'm going to be fine. But it's not about you. It's about everybody. Simple. Wear a mask and we get everything back. It's not that hard. But we're doing that thing we do in the media. This is not a you thing. This is an us thing. This is me talking group talk to everybody who I work with, who I've worked for. I've worked at 3 different places. We do it. Some of it we do because you don't have the attention span, you know, to listen to quotes in totality. Some of it we do because it doesn't make a good headline. A lot of it we do because we see gotcha moments and we just want to pound the gotcha moments, play the hits. But that doesn't make it right. Colin tweeted out earlier today, you mean to tell me a guy that puts himself in harm's way in football is scared of a virus like he gets it. But again, that's only part of the quote. The rest of the quote is accurate, which is, and it's not really about me, it's about everybody else. Essentially, Kirk Cousins is saying, I don't know if masks work or if they don't work. I don't think I'm really going to get sick from it, but I'll wear the damn mask so that everybody else feels good. Fine. I don't care why you wear it. You can wear it to be sarcastic. You can wear it to be cautious. You can wear it to be respectful. You could wear it for a million reasons. Just wear a mask. It's not that hard. And if you don't have a mask, as I lose them all the time, pretty much any place you walk into has them and they'll hand it to you. You couldn't make it any easier for people. This is like the voting thing, right? Like, I love the fact that we're creating more and more avenues for people to vote. If you don't vote, like, this is on you. Last presidential election, I was not registered to vote. The day of the election, I registered to vote and voted. Twice. Kidding on the last part. But we're gonna half of us are gonna vilify Kirk Cousins. Half of us are gonna vilify scientists and doctors saying, see, Kirk Cousins, professional athlete, smart guy. Not a scientist, not a doctor, definitely not an infectious disease expert. Actually, just says, you know, I don't really think it's going to affect me. If I get sick, I get sick. But I'll wear the damn mask because it makes everybody else happy. Fine. Right? Don't care why you wear it. I don't care. Just do it. It's like voting. I don't care who you vote for. Really don't care. Just vote. But this is a good portion of so many stories having to do with the pandemic. You know, the Big Ten and people's, you know, wanting the Big Ten to play football and the idea of the Big Ten presidents being overreacted, that they had overreacted to a report from real scientists and real doctors about something that could happen to their athletes. But Kirk Cousins was asked to elaborate. He did. And while he doesn't believe that he could truthfully get sick or let alone die, because if you did, you wouldn't say that. And nor has he really dug into the idea that, like, a good portion of COVID-19 and the dangerous aspects of it is not just whether or not you could die. Like, we have this tendency to go like, well, you didn't die, so you're fine. No, I mean, it can do massive damage to your lungs. Maybe not Kirk Cousins. But there are people that have lingering and will have a life of lung issues from it. But that's not even the point. The biggest point, most important point is we're doing that thing that we like to do in the media, and it's not a you problem, it's an us problem. We're taking a portion of a quote, making it into a gotcha moment. Kirk Cousins doesn't fear the virus. He doesn't want to wear a mask. He doesn't think the masks actually work. Even though at the end, he essentially says, I'll wear the mask, if nothing else, to be respectful of other people.
Be sure to catch live editions of The Herd weekdays at noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific on Fox Sports Radio, FS1, and the iHeartRadio app.
Doug Gottlieb in for Colin. This is The Herd. Thanks so much for making us part of your day on a Wednesday, hump day. What day is it? It's hump day. What? It's that great commercial with the camel. You guys know the camel hump day commercial, right? Remember we used to have jingles? Whatever happened to jingles? I saw this story and I thought it was interesting. Alvin Kamara is expected to practice today with the New Orleans Saints. Now, Kamara's been doing the hold-in, right? The hold-in is the sleep-under of NFL negotiations. You guys know what a sleep-under is? Okay, a sleep-over, you go over to somebody's house, you throw on a movie, you get a bunch of snacks, you play video, they play Fortnite, they text friends, they IG Live, they Snapchat everybody, they stay up super, super late. They annoy the hell out of whoever parents have them doing a sleepover if the parents pay attention to them. If not, the parents pay no attention. They don't sleep at all. Then they come back to you the next day crazy, crazy cranky and tired, too much sugar, not enough sleep. They end up not liking each other at the end of the day because somebody, no doubt, is an early riser and wakes somebody else up. You know, it's the sleepover. I used to have sleepovers all the time. Sleepovers still exist. The sleep under, is when, we do this with our kids all the time, which is you go over to somebody's house, you hang out, you swim, you play, you watch, play Fortnite, do all that stuff. And then like 9:30, 10 o'clock, we'll come pick you up, you sleep in your own house. And then if you want, the next morning, we'll take you back over there and you have breakfast together. Sleep under. Hold in is, hey, I want a new contract, but I'm not going to not show up. So I don't miss meetings. I know what's going on. I just want a new deal, and this is a way of not making you look bad, having to report that I'm not there. I also can't necessarily get fined. I'm getting all my treatment. I'm getting some of my work in. I'm just not going to go run around, catch passes, run the risk of getting injured, contact, non-contact injury, right? That's the hold in as opposed to the old school, I ain't showing up. Call my agent if you need me. Hold out. Pay me my money. Show me the money! Show me... Okay, you understand the difference, hold out and hold in? Okay. So Alvin Kamara is doing the hold in. And there's some negotiation there. And suddenly yesterday, Josina Anderson tweeted out that the New Orleans Saints are open to trading Alvin Kamara. Like, wait, what? Life comes at you fast, right? And though it's been reported that he didn't ask for Christian McCaffrey money, this is a problem with so many running backs is they massively, massively overplay their hand, right? Joe Mixon signed a contract yesterday. It's essentially a four-year deal. And Joe Mixon's deal is going to pay him $48 million is how it reads, right? Four-year, $48 million contract. And the devil obviously is always in the details. He's going to get a $10 million signing bonus with a $1.3 million base for this year. So he'll make $11.3 this year, $8 next year, $8 the following year, $9.3 in 2023. So it's going to average out to about $9 million a year. Joe Mixon's a starting running back, a franchise back, a really, really good player. And that is well below what Christian McCaffrey made because he's not as productive as Christian McCaffrey. But it's getting long-term stability, getting life-changing, generational wealth as best you can with a declining market to be a running back. But what the Saints did yesterday was call his bluff. Alvin Kamara's bluff. And they've still kind of left it out there. Because at the end of the day, if you don't want to play football, if you don't want to negotiate in real good faith and understand that we can't give you the ball, you're not the kind of, he was hurt last year, they won without him. He's a very good hybrid back. But he's not a bell cow. And you're not going to throw to him 100 times a year. And he hasn't stayed healthy long enough. Outside of the fact that he doesn't catch 100 balls and he doesn't rush for over 1,000 yards, he's exactly like Christian McCaffrey and deserves Christian McCaffrey money. And the only way to truly negotiate is to threaten to walk out that door or send a guy out that door, which is what the Saints did yesterday. Hey, listen, if we can't come to terms, it's fine. We'll find somebody who will overpay to trade you and to give you what you might think is a contract that you're worth. But we're not speaking the same language. In a not-so-shocking turn of events, Alvin Kamara's probably going to practice today. My guess is they'll get a contract done. Although the Saints left it out there, trade is still a possibility. somebody wants to overpay you and you want to negotiate as if you're Christian McCaffrey or you want to negotiate on the plus side of $10 plus million a year, we ain't doing that. Joe Mixon got nine? Probably reasonable to think that's about your range.
Be sure to catch live editions of The Herd weekdays at noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific on Fox Sports Radio, FS1, and the iHeartRadio app.
Doug Gottlieb in for Colin. This is The Herd. Jerry Rice was on 97.5 The Game. He was asked about Dak Prescott and if he had Kyle Shanahan as a head coach as opposed to what he's been working with in Dallas. This was the greatest wide receiver of all time. Jerry Rice had this to say. I think Prescott would have success, but I don't think he would be like Jimmy G. Overall, I think Jimmy G is a better quarterback than Dak. I'm going to call it. Yeah, it's just my opinion. That's my opinion. I can be wrong, but I think right now with Jimmy G, he's a better quarterback than Dak Prescott. Now, he's also synonymous with the 49ers, even though he went to the Super Bowl with the Raiders. Jerry Rice is most known as a Niner, and you know, you can't, when you're a Niner, it's not like college in terms of arch rival, but you're a Niner, it's not like you're going to credit the Cowboys quarterback for being better than the Niners. But I don't think it's a crazy statement. I don't. In fairness to Jimmy G, he's only been a healthy starter for 1 year, right? 1 year, because he got hurt the previous year and the previous year to that, he sat, and then, you know, obviously they were good at the end of the season. I don't know if they got every team's best stuff or people knew what he's doing. The criticism of Jimmy Garoppolo has not been how good he is. It's that he is prone to the big mistake. And in fairness to Dak Prescott, Jimmy Garoppolo didn't make the plays down the stretch. You know, Emmanuel Sanders is open. It wasn't just that he missed Emmanuel Sanders on what should have been an explosive play and maybe a game-winning play. It's that he massively overthrew him, play which if you underthrow, you're likely to get a PI and get the ball down around the one-yard line. So I would, if you told me that Garoppolo didn't play well down the stretch against Kansas City Chiefs in the Super Bowl with the lead, I would agree with you. But what has Dak Prescott done to make you believe that he would perform well down the stretch? Right? If you want to tell me that in a pressure-packed situation like the Super Bowl, he didn't play well, fine. I saw the Philadelphia Eagles game where the Eagles have a bunch of rummies at wide receiver and the Cowboys can't move the football against the Eagles late in the year. Yeah, they had the number one ranked offense based on gross statistics, but go and look at what they actually accomplished. I think Kyle Shanahan's a great offensive mind. Of course not. But, like, coaching can only get you so far. And if anything, Kyle Shanahan, if he was coaching Dak Prescott would hand the ball off more and throw the football less. How do I know that? Because that's how Kyle Shanahan calls offensive football. He just does. Go back and look at the Cowboys last year. And instead of saying they have the number one ranked offense, look what they did against the actual good teams and look what the Niners did against the good teams. Is there some bias there with Jerry Rice? Sure. But one guy's won a bunch of playoff games. The other one's, what, 1-1?
Want more Herd? The Herd streams 24 hours a day, 7 days a week within the iHeartRadio app. Search Herd to listen live or on demand whenever you'd like.
Big game tonight in the NBA. Actually, two of them. The Bucks are down 1-0 to the Miami Heat. Where have I seen this before? Mike Budenholzer's team suddenly not as good offensively in the playoffs as they were in the regular season. And then the nightcap is Houston versus Oklahoma City. Game 7, the winner gets the Lakers. Chris Paul playing against his former team, heroically kind of saved his current team and forced a Game 7. The Rockets are better. The Rockets should win this game. The Thunder weren't put together with the idea of, hey, let's win. They were put together with the idea of, you know, we got Danilo Gallinari. He can score. Maybe he'll become trade bait. We got Chris Paul. He's a tremendous point guard and leader. We'll put him in charge. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander will learn from an all-time great to eventually be the mantle holder, the leader of the team. Steven Adams, the big guy, the tough guy. We'll just kind of figure it out as we go. And somehow by about midseason, you're like, you know what? We can't trade Chris Paul for anything reasonable. Maybe can't trade him at all. And we're not that bad. Let's just go for it. Fine. As for the Houston Rockets, they actually match up a little bit better than we thought because they're using Lu Dort, who's a rookie from Arizona State, originally from Montreal. Looks like a football player. Kind of shoots like a football player sometimes, too. And we have ourselves in a really interesting series. But one thing I think all of us can agree is if the Rockets lose tonight, Mike D'Antoni, like, we don't even need the pleasantries of the, well, we're going to review, everybody's under review, we'll figure it out. Like, D'Antoni will be fired if they lose. There's a chance that Daryl Morey's fired if they lose. Even if they win, there's a very strong likelihood they lose to the Lakers. And when you factor in what Tillman Fertitta said last year when they lost to the Warriors, remember, he wasn't just mad that they lost to the Warriors. He was mad that they lost to the Warriors at home. The Rockets have made this curious kind of run of losing their last playoff game at home. Additionally, in these last playoff games, James Harden kind of no-shows at the end of series. And when they lost to the Warriors last year, if you remember, the Warriors weren't at full strength. Kevin Durant didn't play. So it's one thing to lose to the Warriors. You're like, well, they got Kevin Durant, and they got Steph Curry, and they got Klay Thompson, and they got Draymond Green, and we had come so close before. But they commissioned a study on why they lost Game 7 the year before and blamed the refs, not the 27 missed three-pointers in a row. Then they get another shot at the Warriors, and though they may not have won the series, to lose at home and the Warriors don't have their best player, I'd be mad too. So Fertitta said, like, I want to win, and I want to win now. They clean house with the coaching staff, with the exception of the head coach. Daryl Morey may or may not keep his job, and I don't believe D'Antoni does. Eventually, if they lose. But I feel like the Rockets are in that place that a lot of colleges are in when they want to fire their coach. I'm not saying that Mike D'Antoni is the guy. His teams, and he's coached, I mean, it's kind of an amazing career, right? To coach in three of the four biggest markets in the NBA. Did you guys realize that? He was head coach of the Lakers, the Knicks, the Rockets, fourth biggest market in the, and, you know, as well as Phoenix, where he had the most success he's ever had. And of course, in Denver previous to that, like, it's not for lack of opportunity. Where have I seen this before, that his team's lack of ability to close the series, to get big defensive stops, ultimately undoes an amazing regular season team? That's Mike D'Antoni basketball 101. I'm not saying that you keep him. I'm just saying this. Has anybody asked the question, who's the guy who could fix it? There are calls to bring back Jeff Van Gundy. But Jeff Van Gundy is a Pat Riley disciple. He's a defense guy. How do you think that goes over with James Harden? I love Jeff Van Gundy. There's many teams I'm like, why don't you hire Jeff Van Gundy? Just throw a bunch of money at him. He's a great basketball coach. Great basketball coach. But I don't know how that, when your two best players are two guys with flaws defense, like Russell Westbrook, I think people think is a really good defensive player because he's so athletic, because he makes mean faces. And occasionally he'll get a steal. But the truth is that he checks out of defense for about half of every season, and he's just okay in the postseason when he is engaged. And then offensively, And what happens is we watch in such limited instances in terms of how hard he plays hard all the time. Like, no, he doesn't. He does not. Ask people in Oklahoma City, they'll nod their head like, no, he takes games off defensively. And now, of course, he's four knee surgeries in. He's not the same guy, and he still has some of the same issues in terms of the volume of shots and inability to make shots. Then you got James Harden, who's great when he has the ball. Great. He's not good. He's great. But he requires a very specific style in order to be successful, right? Like, I don't know if there's a lot of coaches that are going to let him go through his legs 15 times before he goes and gets his shot. Maybe. But the bigger question is, okay, not D'Antoni. Who then? And don't give me the anybody. That's not the way it works. Because in order to win a championship, so oftentimes in the NBA, you have to have been there before. You have to have won before. Like, that's the catch-22 of coaching in the NBA. To win a championship as a coach, you have to have won a championship as a coach. Or to have the respect of a locker room, you have to have won a championship. To win a championship, you have to have the respect of a locker room. Reminds me of Fat Bastard in Austin Powers 2. I eat because I'm unhappy, and I'm unhappy because I eat. It's a vicious cycle. I agree. I'm not a guy who's sitting here proposing I have all the answers. But I think the lack of an obvious answer is the conundrum that the Houston Rockets are in. Do you keep Daryl Morey? He did build this team into a consistent winner. He did pull off some magnificent moves, but he does have them locked up in a sort of cap hell that they've constantly tried to rework. And if you keep him, do you hire a coach that believes in his analytics first philosophy? Or do you scrap the whole thing and start over? But then you're not going to get rid of James Harden. You can't get rid of Russell Westbrook. What do you do? You might be screwed. That, right? Warriors seem to have a plan, took a year off. Lakers are still going to roll with LeBron. Clippers are loaded. They're not going anywhere for a while. Then there's you.
Be sure to catch live editions of The Herd weekdays at noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific on Fox Sports Radio, FS1, and the iHeartRadio app.
The book is called The Dynasty. Jeff Benedict is the author. The New England Patriots, the most dominant franchise in professional team sports over the past 20 years, are the subject of a brand new book by Jeff Benedict. Benedict secured exclusive access to the Patriots starting in 2018 and reported from within the organization for nearly 2 years. The book is a comprehensive account based upon 250 interviews and has more than 200 people and is available now. I know that Colin has read it because he's calling me on a nightly basis telling me, you got to read this book. You got to read this book. We talked about it yesterday. We're joined by Jeff Benedict, the author. Jeff, how are you?
I'm doing well, thanks.
What was it like the moment you were granted access? And I ask that because of the organizations that we as outsiders think of as the Fort Knox of sports organizations, the Patriots seem like the most like that, right? No leaks. Nothing gets out of that thing. It's changed a little bit, but to give you this type of access, what was that like?
Well, I mean, I think to answer that question, I have to sort of say up front, I'm probably the ultimate outsider, you know, maybe like the most unlikely person to write a book like this, just because I had never covered this team. I'd never been around them, never been to a press conference in Foxborough, never watched a game from the press box. And I didn't know any of these individuals who are at the core of the dynasty. I've never met, for example, Robert Kraft or been around Tom Brady or Bill Belichick or any of these other guys. So I was really an outsider. But I'd spent a lot of time thinking about this and thinking about what I wanted to do. And one of the things that appealed to me was that no one had really ever looked at the role of the owner in the dynasty. And I was fascinated by that because I had consulted the Sports Illustrated 100 Greatest Sports Books of All Time. They made a list a few years back, and not one of those titles had anything to do with an owner. And I thought, in this case, there's got to be an incredible story there. I don't know what it is, but there's got to be a great story about Kraft's part here. And so I wrote to him, you know, the old-fashioned way. I wrote him a letter, and it's the ultimate sort of cold call type of letter. He doesn't know me, but I introduced myself in writing, and I told him who I was, what my background was, and what I wanted to do, and which was I really wanted to understand and write a book about how the greatest sports dynasty of the 21st century was built. I mean, that's basically how I put it. And that was the beginning of a relationship. That the next phase was I got a letter back from him and to my mailbox in Connecticut. And that said something to me about him. Now, granted, I haven't talked to him yet. I haven't met him. But the fact that he took the time to write me back was interesting, and it said to me, there's something different about this man. And, you know, eventually that led to meeting and spending time together, and me basically just talking about what I wanted to do and getting to know him and some of those who led the organization. I was trying to build a rapport. I was trying to understand, and they were, you know, trying to understand who I was because they didn't know me either. But it was a process in the case with everybody in the book of, you know, sort of building a comfort level and a relationship. I mean, to get to the point where you could have interviews that were meaningful. I think that all of these guys knew, because of the kinds of questions that I was asking, that I was not interested in third and 10. There's a lot of other football writers out there who can write that a lot better than I can. I was trying to answer questions about that were legal, that were political, that right. were financial. And so that's, it's going about it a totally different way.
Yeah, it is. Look, it is fascinating to those of us. And, you know, I spent, well, I lived 12 years of my life in Connecticut. And I know that, like, I think people forget that the Patriots were moving to Connecticut. Like, that stadium that UConn occupies, that was going to be the Patriots stadium. Like, it was done until it wasn't done. And it's kind of interesting how he took to owning the team, where he, you know, he bought up land around the stadium and then ultimately gets the new stadium. But I think that part of it's fascinating. I think the part that is most intriguing to us sports fans is the relationship between Belichick and Brady. And having not had the, whether it's bias or background of knowledge for how it used to be, when you first got there in 2018, what was the state of their relationship?
When I got there in 2018, I didn't know anything about that and have any sort of insight into any of that. I was coming in very fresh, and you could even say somewhat naive. But, you know, I constructed a timeline and of the Patriots dynasty. It took me a year to build it. And I was doing all these data points, and I was looking at the evolution of the relationship between Belichick and Brady as a fascinating tale. And I think to understand where it ended up, you have to really focus on where it began. And it begins really with this incredible sort of set of decisions that Belichick makes that in hindsight, you know, look just as risky today as they were then. Which is, you know, first of all, drafting a quarterback when you absolutely don't need one because you've got three of them and one of them is a superstar. And then after the first season, when Brady doesn't play, it's reaching the conclusion in your mind that if he were starting the best quarterback on the roster right now, heading into the 0-1 season, he would start Brady. That is, wow. That is an unbelievable place for a coach to be when the owner just gave the other quarterback $103 million to stay for 10 more years. And he even told the owner that he felt that way. And so Kraft knows that Belichick feels that way going into the 0-1 season. And I think when Drew gets hurt, it gives Belichick the ability to put the guy in the game who he thought he should have been starting anyways. And so when Drew comes back, and the conventional wisdom is, you don't, when you're the star quarterback, you don't lose your job.
Yeah.
And so he should have played. And I think every other coach in the NFL in 01 would have put him back in. And Belichick doesn't. And here's where it gets interesting. The owner certainly could have forced his hand here. And he's even talking with Bledsoe, who wants him to intervene. And Kraft goes and talks to Belichick about it. And the interesting thing is, he doesn't go down there and, like, tell him what to do. He goes down there and listens to him. And then he decides at that point that he's not going to step in. And he tells Bledsoe that. And he tells Bledsoe that he, as much as he wants to help, he doesn't think he should force the issue. And so Belichick is allowed to stick with Brady. And we all know that he wins the Super Bowl that year. But the next morning, when they're in a car together after winning the Super Bowl against the Rams, it's right there where, you know, Belichick says you had a pretty good season. Well, first of all, that's a dramatic understatement. And second of all, but coming from him, that's a huge compliment.
Sure.
And then to say, then comes the sort of the warning about what's coming next, the fame and the all the stuff that comes with being the youngest quarterback to be the Super Bowl MVP and all that stuff. that's how their relationship started. It's, in other words, I think that they both understood early on that they had to trust each other, and their careers rested on each other.
So,
and they really did. If Brady had not done well in 01, that could have been disastrous for Belichick's future.
So
he staked a lot on him.
So where did the trust break down? And like, look, we read the excerpt yesterday where, yeah, you know, Kraft was concerned about the dynamic between Belichick and Brady. Belichick, of course, had gotten rid of Alex Guerrero. Giselle would, you know, voiced her disapproval with how Tom Brady was being treated. Like, it seemed to all work for so long, where Brady would take a little bit less and extend the contract so they could get everything worked in. You know, he would get undressed verbally by the coaching staff because he was just like anybody else at the Patriots. It worked for so long. What changed?
I don't really think anything changed. I just think what you said explains it. It worked for so long. In other words, it never should have worked that long. Montana and Walsh couldn't make it work that long. Noel and Bradshaw, you know, Terry Bradshaw has been pretty open about how much he hated Chuck Noll, and couldn't wait to get away from him. And so I think that, again, I'm looking at this, like, and I'm trying to get readers to put on a different set of glasses and let's look at this differently. Instead of focusing, and I understand the attraction to the friction, I get that. But what's far more interesting to me isn't that there was friction and fracture, because that's in every great partnership. That, you know, when you put like two geniuses in a room, there's going to be that, but they're also going to create something that could like change the world. And I think that these two guys did that, and they did it for a lot longer than should have happened. And if they'd run the course that the Niners and the Steelers and maybe even the Packers had run, it would have come apart a lot sooner, maybe in 2010 or 2011 or certainly 2012. But this is different because they keep going. And so it's, by the time you get to 20 years, you know, 2019, it's like, it's just, there's not a defining moment where you say, ah, there it is. That was the straw that broke the camel's back. I just think that instead it's more that they finally reached the end of the road. And that is why I made the comparison between Lennon and McCartney and Belichick and Brady, because I really think it fits here. I think it works. It's not an overstatement to say,
yep,
the two greatest rock stars that changed the music industry. We're 50 years removed from, you know, when the Beatles were the Beatles, and we still look at them as the best. I really think 50 years from now, sports historians and fans will look back at this moment and say, the Belichick-Brady partnership, it's still the best one. And it's because they did more than anybody else.
Could it also be that Giselle Bundchen is the Yoko Ono to this duo?
No, I don't think so. I think I would I understand why you're saying that. I would actually describe her quite differently. I think Yoko is probably rightfully looked at by a lot of people as one of the sources that broke up the Beatles. I think in Giselle's case, she was probably very helpful in keeping things together because of the way that she is with Tom. I think if you see Tom versus Time in that film, which I thought was very honest and showed some great insights into that. I mean, look, she's like the ultimate partner. And I think that New England was lucky that she was on the scene for this ride.
It's called The Dynasty. The author, Jeff Benedict, kind of to spend some time with us. Pick it up wherever you Kindle, Amazon, wherever you get your books. It is an absolute fabulous read. Jeff, thanks so much for joining us. Incredible insight, and look forward to speaking with you again in the near future.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
The pleasure is absolutely all mine.